Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 275 featuring Jody Madden, CEO of Foundry, an amazing company that creates great software such as Nuke, Katana, Mari, Moto. Really great stuff that is coming out of there. Obviously, Nuke is something I'm very familiar with. They came originally from Digital Domain, which is where I originally met Jody. She and I were both at Digital Domain around the same time. Of course, I was not management as she is, but I was just a lowly artist over there. But I've always been impressed with her. She is very, very inspirational, excellent communicator, and really inspiring. Didn't you find her inspiring, Kristen?
Her from being 21 years old, just coming out of college, and then she was a leader at ILM at 21. And she kind of talks about, you asked her, like, was she intimidated? And she said kind of the lack of fear and her youth, just not knowing anything, kind of made her career skyrocket. And she became, her leadership style is awesome. Kind of how you talked about it, even at Digital Domain, she kind of like sits with people and connects. And that was amazing to hear about.
Yeah, she's really, really cool. And I really appreciate all the stuff that she's done and in terms of some of the things that are going on in the company. We also talked quite a bit about our current situation in terms of, obviously, you know, our forced isolation situation and how we're all working from home and how that's going to be changing the way that people work and the way that people interact with their software. And I thought that was a pretty good conversation, too, that we had, right?
Yeah, that was really interesting.
Yeah, we can all learn from that. There's some really good stuff that was going on. I really liked it. This is a test again. We are trying to do our video podcast. We are still learning, so stick with us. Jody's video, unfortunately, was going out a few times, especially at the beginning, was going out quite a bit. So her video was going out, but towards the end, she's pretty much all of her video was fine. So if you're watching it on video, please forgive our dust as we're figuring out how to make these video things work. But it's fun. You guys seem to be liking it, so we're keeping up with the videos, right? Kristen and I are putting on our best face, and I'm putting on a nice fish shirt today. Let's see. We've got some announcements. What are some of our announcements, Kristen?
All right. So V-Ray 5 for 3D's Max beta is now available. It came out, we did that last week. And you can find this out at chaosgroup.com, all the information to try it out.
That's right. So if you guys are V-Ray users and you'd like to try the beta, you should do that. This is V-Ray 5. This is a major release. There is a huge amount of things that are going on to V-Ray 5. So you guys should totally check it out. I am in the middle of writing some blog posts about it. I'm writing one about the new light mix feature of the new frame buffer. Sounds very specific, but it's really incredible. Lots of cool stuff. So lots of things to check out. Go check it out. V-Ray 5 for 3ds Max, available now for in beta to try out. And all the other platforms will be coming soon. So don't ask, well, where is it for Maya? Where is it for this? It's coming. Don't worry, it's coming. So we're excited about that. And then what other announcements we have?
The education collection, which we've been talking about, that is out, and it's $150 a year. And this includes all our V-Ray products, except for Katana and Nuke, but Phoenix and Vermaya and Max are also included in the collection.
That's right. I'm just going to bundle in the other thing we also talk about, which is the PLE version. So the education version is available for anyone who is in school or currently teaching or anyone in the academic world. $150 a year gets you all of the V-Ray, all the Chaos Group products, V-Ray and Phoenix, et cetera, with the only two exceptions being V-Ray for Nuke and V-Ray for Katana. And there's some complications behind why that's the case, but just stick with us. You get all the other ones, including Moto and Houdini and all the Phoenixes. But the PLE version is for anyone who wants to try out V-Ray for Maya. You can do it, and it is free. There are some restrictions because it is a PLE version, which is the Personal Learning Edition. So there's stuff going on there. And this kind of relates back to what we had talked about with Jody about companies giving out software for people to educate themselves and learn more about the software and the difference between commercial software and proprietary software, because obviously products like Nuke was proprietary and became, you know, commercial. So it's very interesting to have that whole conversation about that stuff. Okay, and I think that's it for our announcements, right?
Yep.
Okay, great. So, yeah. So if you guys do enjoy this podcast in YouTube form, make sure and subscribe to us. Sean will be taking care of us in on the YouTube side of things and making sure that it's all going up there. But give us, you know, let us know in the comment section what you think, if you have any ideas, if you want to help us out, if you want to have say, hey, you know, Chris, next time you should do this, or Kristen, how about you bring in this guest? I have some ideas. We've got some very good guests coming up, so you should be excited about that. And not all of our podcasts will be video, but we're going to try to make the most as many as we can coming up, so that'll be cool. And if you want to learn more about the podcast in general, where can you go?
You can go to facebook.com/cggaragepodcast or chaosgroup.com/cggarage.
Perfect. And if you have any other ideas or comments or anything, just go to labs@chaosgroup.com, email us there. Again, that's labs@chaosgroup.com, and let us know what your ideas and thoughts are. And of course, if you have, we'd always appreciate a rating on Apple Podcast as well. That's always welcome. All right. That being said, please enjoy this incredible podcast with Miss Jody Madden.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
You've listened to some of these podcasts. You said you listened to the one with Vicky, right?
I have, yeah. I listened to the one with Vicky, and then, of course, I listened to the one, the Magnopus Takeover with Sally and team. That was good. You were definitely outnumbered.
Yes. No, there's, in fact, I am wearing a Sally Slade t-shirt today.
I love that. That's
which
good.
It says 300 rows on it, which was the last we were celebrating when we were leaving the old facility, sort of commemorating that day. But it was, I figured it's like, this would be a good shirt to wear.
That's
today.
A good one. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a good podcast. Sally is a very, very bright girl. And I've known her for a long time. And her and Kat and Emily were phenomenal on that episode. I loved
it. Yeah. That was great.
Yeah. I just actually sent them a video about how to play Dungeons and Dragons online now that it's the same situation.
You know? Exactly.
So anyway, we're doing that, but I don't want to get too much into that. I want to get into you. So obviously I met you over at Digital Domain when you mm-hmm. and I were both there. It was my second tour of duty at Digital Domain.
Yeah.
But you have a very, very interesting background. I was always fascinated by your leadership style at Digital Domain. I was very, very impressed by it. And so I always sort of want to know more about you. And this is a great opportunity to let people know about it. So all I know is that it started at Stanford, but did it start before that?
No, you know, Stanford's a good starting point. Gosh, it's, it's hard to believe that I graduated more than 20 years ago now. But yes, it started at Stanford, grew up in California on the Central Coast, went north for school. And of course, at that time, mid late 90s, everyone coming out of Stanford was focused on the internet boom. You know, it was the early employees at Google, the guys at Yahoo had come out of the dorm. And, you know, not unlike some of the stories Vicky told ongoing, some of those interviews, I met with people and the fit just didn't seem right, you know, and my background was not in engineering and it certainly wasn't in art either. I was an English lit and communication background. So I studied social science.
Okay.
And when I got out of school, I knew I wanted to stay in the Bay Area. And it was around that time, actually, that Lucas had announced the building of the Lucas Digital Art Center and that mm-hmm. they had gotten approval to build the studio at the Presidio. And at that point in time, I thought, gosh, what what an incredible place with an fascinating mix of talent, you know, and this intersection between technology and art was always something that was fascinating to me. Right. So ended up thinking about grad school for a bit, decided against it, realized I would be a terrible teacher, and sent in an application for a PA job. Okay. Of course, got turned down, you know, got the usual, sorry, you're not qualified to do this. And then you go back wondering, how do I become qualified to become a PA? But ended up actually getting called back for a job that I didn't know what it was at the time. It was a digital resource coordinator job. And in fact, it was about working with the internal teams that were managing all the digital resources for ILM at the time. So everything from disk space to all of the EO2s that were on artist desks to the render servers at the big old Origins back in those days, two decades ago. Yeah. And that was my first job.
Wow. But that's a lot of technology to throw at you all at once, isn't it?
It was. It really was. And that wasn't... it was fascinating, though, and I think seeing what it took to produce at that point in time visual effects for film and commercials 20 years ago, and the dependency on technology and the intersection with the creative teams was fascinating to me, you know, and the groups of people continually pushing the boundaries, all the things that teams, you know, take for granted now, you know, basic, like not having enough disk space for a single shot and having to spill discs and write things out to tape. And it was great to see how far the teams could push the technology that we did have, both hardware and software.
Right. Yeah. But so what was your feeling about going into all this technology? Was it something that you thought about, like, oh yeah, I really want to get involved in how to get all this tech to work? And, you know, that's a lot of stuff to deal with, right?
It was. I think it was actually, it was how that came together in service of the creative and the intersection with that and the business, and how those things all aligned. And I think from even an operational perspective, how you dealt with competition for all of those resources, and what that meant over time and how it was managed across teams, both from the early stages of bidding all the way through delivery. Those were fascinating problems to me. And I was given the first opportunity I had at managing a team about 9 months later. You know, and to your earlier question about leadership, managing a team was never something that was a goal for me at all. And in fact, I think my immediate response when asked to do it was I wasn't interested. I was quite happy alone in the corner doing my job. that didn't last for very long, though, and ended up enjoying it quite a lot.
Yeah, it's funny. I think there's some people who are reluctant to be leaders, and then there are some people who are sort of want to be leaders. But I think the people who are reluctant sometimes realize that they have a skill set that they didn't realize. And the thing that I think was really good about some of the leadership skills that I saw in you is that you went in there with the idea of the team working, not you working, right? And so Absolutely. When the team does really good things, then you get excited about it because you've made a really great team. So I think that's a difference. And that's probably, it makes sense that you were reluctant to be a team leader because I don't think that wasn't like, I want to be a leader. You know, it was like, nope, you want to make a team. And it was fun doing that.
Exactly. And I think that was, you know, I was fortunate to be given that opportunity at, you know, all of 21, I think, at the time. And
wow,
to see how fulfilling that was, you know, and it really, exactly as you said, it was about enabling other people and enabling people to do what they're great at. And it had nothing to do with what I could produce myself. And that was, I think, probably one of the most important lessons in any sort of management or leadership role. It really was about removing blockers for the team and ensuring they had everything they needed to be successful. And I think in some ways, because I was fortunate enough to then in following roles have the opportunity to work with engineers, truly people whose jobs I had never done myself and wouldn't have the capability to do. It forced me in many ways to focus on the connections, figuring out how to accelerate their work, figuring out how to better align them with what we were trying to achieve as a business. Because I couldn't get into the code. I couldn't debate with them how a rack was going to be built in a data center.
Right.
So it was really ensuring that their strengths could shine and that they could really add value in the most important way possible. So I think being positioned in a role where you can't do a job yourself, it sets you down a path in an interesting way to approach it. But yeah, that's really been the common thread in, gosh, the 8 roles I had there at ILM and Lucasfilm, all
right.
of my roles at Digital Domain, and really what led me back to management at Foundry.
Yeah, but let's also, you know, you said you're 21 years old, you're mm-hmm. a woman in the tech industry, and you're going into a leadership position. That must there must have been some challenges in that position as a young woman.
There were, I think, also at that age, though, it's the lack of experience to know any better. Perhaps there would have been more fear had I been had a bit more years behind me.
Okay.
You know, I think the benefit of youth and perhaps lack of fear at that point, because everything is so new. And
right.
I think one of the most amazing things, and, you know, I know you hear this all the time in
yeah.
your interviews, the willingness of people to share knowledge in this industry is truly exceptional, you know, and
yes.
people that are the best at what they do, their willingness to share knowledge and their patience and willingness to share with a 21-year-old kid in a job maybe she shouldn't have even been in was really exceptional.
Right.
And that, you know, I feel lucky to have been a part of that everywhere that I've worked. And now partners, customers, our team, that's really, it's an exception that you don't see that. And I think in general, approaching a situation or a team with the attitude that you are there to support, enable them, I think that's a much easier approach than if it were about me. And I think, you know, what you were highlighting before about some leaders wanting, whether it's the spotlight or the focus to be on them and what they're contributing,
mm-hmm.
That's never been my approach. And
yeah.
nothing I would be comfortable doing anyway. You know, I've been lucky enough to work with people that can create things that I could never have the capacity to create on my own. And so to have a part in supporting that, enabling that, ensuring they have what they need to be successful and getting things out of their way, that's the most satisfying thing I could be doing.
Well, it sounds, you know, based on what you were saying, that people are willing to share a lot of knowledge, it sounds to
mm-hmm.
me like you're basically asking more questions than giving answers,
absolutely.
Which is a good thing, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I guess that's true. You're right. If you trust your team, then you're basically going to rely on them to give you answers rather than you giving them the answers they need to hear, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in those intersections as well. You know, I think we have such incredible experts in particular areas, whether that's deep creative expertise, deep technical expertise, people that are running businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times people have, by definition in their roles, spend a lot of time in their functional area. And I was always
right.
fascinated by the intersections of those and how they came together. And I think when I look back on the opportunities that I was given, the vast majority of the roles didn't exist in their current form before I stepped into them. You know, they were born out of business need at a particular point in time or growth in an organization or across organizations. And so getting to focus in on what a team needs at that particular moment to be best connected to the others that are going to help make the larger group succeed, I think was a great place for me to focus my energy, and incredibly
right.
fulfilling.
Well, it sounds like you really found your voice and the way that you want to be able to find your leadership and style over at Lucasfilm, and that's great. How did that lead you to Digital Domain?
That my last roles at Lucasfilm at the time was with the Systems Operations Engineering Group,
mm-hmm.
and they were incredible. During those years, they, you know, building Lucas Digital Art Center, the consolidation of the technology across the Lucas companies, the opening of the animation studio in Singapore. So there was a lot consolidated in those
yeah.
last few
That's
years.
A lot. Yeah.
And, you know, at that point in time, the CTO, VP of production and visual effects supervisor, so Kim LeBrey, Cliff Plumer, Mark Miller, when they left Lucasfilm to go to Digital Domain. Was curious to see what challenges they were taking on. You know, being in the Bay Area, we were always one step removed from the industry in LA, and I was curious. And so about a year later, went down to visit. Similar problems of scaling the organization.
Yep.
Lots of work had been taking on, as you know. And it was, it had always been a successful team at DD because of the talent there, you know, and
right.
I think is, you know, the teams were exceptional at pulling together and had history to do incredible work. But a lot of the support structure to continue scaling that wasn't in place at the time. And it seemed like something that I could help with. So made the decision to leave the Bay Area. And so in 2007, moved down to DD.
Yeah.
So right around the time Benjamin Button was going on, pre-Tron, that group of shows. So it was after, you know, almost 8 years in the Bay Area and got to see so much, but it seemed like a new challenge.
Yeah. Well, it was definitely a really, really interesting to me. Obviously, you know, as I mentioned, I've been to DD a couple of times. So the first time I was there was still during the Scott Ross days. And then I went back during the second version. And was there during the transition to the third version of DD, which you were a part of that. And, you know, that was an extraordinary challenge for that company and for you guys as management.
Absolutely.
And sitting here as an observer, I think you remember what was so incredible to me was the fact that you guys would had these open forums to tell us what was going on. I was always one of the first people to raise my hands, as you probably remember, because I was very curious about how this was going to affect everyone. And you guys were always very forthright about what was happening. And this was a real challenge and how we were going to deal with, you know, the looming idea of bankruptcy. And because this is obviously happens to a lot of visual effects company.
Yeah,
I got to say, the fact that we went through that entire transition and not a single paycheck got skipped is incredible. And it is a testament to the leadership that was happening at that time, because that was not, it just wouldn't seem possible that we could do that. And we did. How was it for you from your side? I mean, obviously, it's long gone. That's the story's past and everything. Everyone's moved on and everyone's in a great shape right now. But that must have been a real challenge for you as you know, someone from, you know, from business and from management point of view. How did you deal with that?
It's a great question. And it's, you know, looking back now, gosh, 7.5 years later, there's still... there's still lessons that I learned then about transparency and information share in the face of uncertainty that I've reflected on a lot in the last 90 days. You know, when the team of people at DD and the team in Florida as well, facing uncertainty about bankruptcy and job loss and the impact that that has on someone's livelihood and their home and ability to pay rent. That's real and brings together a team of people in a way that few other things do, you know, and this recent crisis and health on top of that and wide economic impact. The common word there, though, I think is uncertainty. And more than ever, being able to share the information that you do have, being able to be quite clear about what you don't know, and not trying to pretend to have all of those answers. You know, I'm sure that during that time, you and others asked questions and we had less answers, certainly than there were questions. But the entire team working together at that point in time was, one, to share as much as humanly possible, two, to protect as many jobs as possible in the service of being able to continue to deliver the projects we had and deliver for our customers on the commitments we made so that we would make it to the other side and be able to win more work and continue on, and that DD, albeit in a different incarnation, would exist when we got to the other side. And when you're that aligned on goals and they're so clear at every single level, it really does bring people together. So whatever the hours are, when you're that aligned, in a way, it simplifies things. The noise really, really drops away.
Yeah.
And it's all about taking care of those priorities, and there's nothing else left.
Yeah, and I think there's a thing specifically, transparency, as you mentioned, is so important, right? Because you may not know, and sometimes that's not necessarily something that you want to communicate, but sometimes it is to sell. It's like, I don't know, and we don't know, but we're going to come out this together, because then the team that's behind you is going to trust you and say, okay, well, we'll do what we can, to do what we can to preserve what we can. And so that was the transparency was an incredibly refreshing, to be honest, because that doesn't always happen. Some people are like, no, everything's going to be okay, and then suddenly, like, the rug gets pulled out from under you, and
Yeah,
that's
it's
just
a
not fair.
surprise.
Yeah, so
No,
it's hard.
people need information, and I think in any situation, whether it's a crisis situation, facing a bankruptcy, someone even interviewing for another job, they need information to make decisions. And it's my job to help provide that information. And in the case where we were at DD, if that meant the information to take another opportunity elsewhere to preserve their livelihood and a paycheck, they needed the information to be able to do that. And, I found in my career supporting people by giving them the information to make the decisions they need to make for themselves long term, it's always paid off. And withholding that information, I've never seen it happen that way. So, yes, it was an intense time, and I was very would never wish that on anyone, any
Neither would
organization
I. Yeah.
to go through that. But to come out the other side, with people that genuinely tried to work towards the same goal in the best way they knew possible, I think was the best outcome we could hope for.
Right. Absolutely. And I'm sure, I mean, we're going to jump back and forth a little bit, but I'm
Yeah.
sure that obviously from that period, like you were mentioning, it's like you must have learned so much how to deal with crisis in some ways that in a situation, and it's an unknown, right? Like, for example, like you mentioned, the last 90 days, something no one would have anticipated if
Yeah.
you told them, 6 months ago, has happened and completely disrupted the entire economic system and social situation of the entire planet.
Yeah.
Somehow, we need to figure out how to adapt to this new world. How did you think what happened to you, like you said, what happened in, during that time of crisis at DD has given you tools to help you deal with it today? And what
Yeah.
have you been able to use?
I think the what I learned during that time at DD about how uncertainty would impact different people in different ways, I think has been extremely valuable. I think the complexity of what we're all experiencing now, as I said, both at a public health crisis standpoint and a global economic crisis all at the same time, but then different groups of people experiencing that differently and at different times, depending on where you are in the world, what part of the industry you're in. There's a lot to that. And I think, over the past few months, first and foremost, again, you focus on the health and safety of your team. There's nothing more important than that, because at the end of the day, if they aren't taken care of, at a human level, number one, nothing works. And two, we certainly can't be there to support our customers, support their transitions and what they're going through over that period of time. So I think
Right.
it's being respectful and empathetic where any one person is on a given day, because there's good days and there's bad right now, and while we see some customers and we've watched our team in APAC actually start to come out of the other side and see green shoots of recovery, there's other team members and other customers that are actually entering into the most uncertain time, uncertain at a personal level, uncertain if jobs are going to be there, and when the work's going to run out. So it's a bit of a roller coaster in that way. And I think remaining centered on those priorities, and again, information share, because nobody knows right now, and gaining new information and applying that and refining that refining our path forward, I think more important than ever, you know, and being willing to make decisions and work towards a particular direction without having all the information, because no one has it right now.
No, they don't. But it's got to be, it's got to be challenging, because you have to adapt very quickly. You know, people, Absolutely. You know, a lot of technology companies suddenly had changed their policies about certain things in a matter of days. And that's challenging to put that into practice. You can say something, you know, and say, this is what we're going to do, but actually doing it is a lot more work than that. I mean, that must have been a real challenge for your team, right?
It was. And I think, you know, interesting being a UK-based company going through the whole process we went through actually for GDPR a few years ago, and the focus on data and privacy actually was great training ground from a policy standpoint, infrastructure standpoint, all of that bar that we had to meet there. And of course, since then, you know, we've had acts in California with consumer privacy, et cetera, but it actually raised the bar in a really healthy way for the organization. I think, you know, for us at Foundry, the challenge that we weren't ready to go fully remote for, that we really spent those last, I would say, the last 4 weeks before I made the decision to close the remaining four offices, it was, as you would expect, it's the performance workstations the teams are dependent on, you know, not unlike you guys when you're doing builds across three OSs, how you support that in a fully remote environment is a challenge. And that's really, you know, gosh, the unsung heroes, the folks in IT and DevOps that never get credit for anything. It's when they really shine working with the engineering team to pull it off. So, you know, relatively quickly, once I made the decision to shut down the offices, the teams were able to test and we're getting builds out the door. You know, it's not perfect, certainly, and it's not running at 100%, but they are making it work.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, when you ask that to, you know, in the middle of developing a new version or doing beta testing or whatever you're doing, and then like suddenly, you know, you ask your IT person to basically change the tires on your car while it's still moving. And that's
and moving that's fast. Really, and I don't want to slow down.
And moving fast. Yeah. So I was like, oh, yeah, it's a real challenge. And I don't know, you know, how people respond to that, but it's real, it's really tough. And I think they're right. I think that they're, you know, that there are a lot of people out there that need to be credited for the, or at least, you know, celebrated for the work they're doing. Because, you know, while, you know, there is obviously a lot of people in the healthcare industry need to be celebrated for the work they're doing, but there are people in the IT department that are keeping people's jobs just by being able to make that happen. And those people need to be, you know, they're part of the economic solution that's going on right now. And also keeping us safe. And that's really, you're absolutely right that we should be celebrating those people.
Yeah, they've enabled this flexibility that is keeping so many people working, know, that without their expertise in getting this set up, we wouldn't be. So there's a lot of people besides everyone, of course, on the front lines that are keeping us, you know, up and running right now. So overall, I think, again, when the priorities are so clear and so much of the other noise drops away and it is about coming together and supporting our customers and helping them get remote and get set up via VPN or a different license or whatever it takes to work in this newly flexible environment, being able to do that. But there's something really powerful about that focus as well. And I think the way that people are willing to give each other the benefit of the doubt and come together as a team, it's been really impressive.
But do you think that, I mean, there's a friend of mine who doesn't like to drive, but decides he's going to take the train from Duarte to Santa Monica. It's 2.5 hours each way every day. So it's 5 hours on the train that he does. And suddenly now he's working from home and he goes, oh my God, I just saved myself 5 hours of commuting that I don't have to do anymore.
Yeah.
And he goes, I don't know why I would ever go back to work. Why can't I just do this from all the time? So do you think that in the end, while this has been very tough, everything else, we are going to learn a new way of working that may actually be better in some, for some people?
I think your friend is on to something there. I think what we've learned in these forced experiments, if you will, about ways of working, about how to be most effective as a team, whether that's a development team, whether that's a product team trying to do discovery, or a marketing team running a digital event. And in fact, they're actually reaching 4,000 people instead of 400 because of the way they approached it. There have been a ton of learnings already to come out of this. You know, even as simple as how we run a meeting with a distributed team. You know, I had someone tell me the other day who's always actually a remote worker and said, you know, for the first time, I really feel like I'm part of the team because it's a level playing field. I'm not the odd man out anymore. And the way that we're having to work together changed the dynamic. And I thought, you know, what an interesting insight into how we can change even how we run a meeting to make create greater opportunity for everyone's voices to be heard. So yes, I do. I think, you know, in the short term, there's learnings I know we're already applying both internally and in how we interact with our customers. And long term, I think as we all gain more clarity on what this means for long term changes in the industry, how we engage with each other, I do think there will be more. And I think they'll continue to be revealed over the next 3, 6, 9 months.
Yeah. And it's funny because there's things that have happened that people say would never happen. And because they're forced to happen, they did happen. And we proved them wrong. It's like, we'll never be able to work from home because we're working on all these very secret movies. It's like, well, guess what? If you have no choice, then you are. And you found a solution somehow. and then suddenly you're like, oh, that's okay. That's possible. And I think it's interesting to think about the idea of remote work, because not everyone is going to have the kind of work that was done in visual effects or the kind of work that you need for using Nuke or Katana or whatever. It's going to require high-end computers, right? It's going to require a lot of power to do that. And if you're working from home, you don't necessarily have that ability to, you know, have a $10,000 or $20,000 box sitting at your desk. So remote work is going to become interesting. Remote working into that idea. And cloud has become, obviously we've been dealing with cloud at Chaos Group for a while, but just the idea of understanding how people can interact on the cloud is fascinating. I mean, is this something that you guys have been, I'm sure this is something you guys have been exploring for a while.
It has. And even, you know, for a period of time there, we had our team focused on Athera and specifically a full cloud platform end to end, and made the decision last fall to actually pivot away from a commercial offering. You know, we found in the market that it was too early, and really where our customers were at then and where we continue to see for the near term, at least, is it's more of a hybrid environment. You know, rare is the case where it's a production that it's a true cloud environment, everything from workstations to your license servers to storage, render processing, databases to make it work. And so that while there were people that successfully delivered visual effects that way, that wasn't the first step. However, a lot of those learnings, and even, you know, over the last 3 or 4 months, as we've seen studios go to this remote setup, largely through remote workstation, through VPNing in, simplest solution, of course, because all of their infrastructure already exists. I do think, to your point about performance workstations and people thinking differently about that next round of capital investment, what about virtual workstations? You know, because it is, you are paying as you go on that. If you know what kind of spec you need to do that type of work, how important is it to have that anymore? You know, and as people, you know, go into this next cycle of investment, how do they change where they really invest? You know, is it important to have just core infrastructure and everything else is elastic on top of that? You know, at the end of the day, if you figure out how to move the data around, does it really matter? You know, I think if you asked most of our customers right now, if there was one thing they could have changed going into it, most of them would tell you they'd wish they had a bigger pipe into their studio to move the data back and forth because everyone is remote.
It's surprised. I mean, we were joking. It's like, I'm surprised the internet hasn't broken, but it's proven. Because it's proven. I was like, wow. You know, I'm also really glad about 6 months ago, I ended up getting fiber for my house. Like, I'm just going to go ahead and get fiber. And I'm like, I'm so
wise
glad
decision.
I have it. Yeah.
Very so glad wise I had, decision.
Yeah. So I'm really had it. Well, for, yeah, I'm glad I have it now, but it is interesting, right? Because then it becomes, then you're, it's the idea was, you know, you may remember back in the early 2000s, the idea was that you're no, having a big computer is not going to be as important as having a fast internet connection, right?
Exactly.
And a fast internet, you know, yeah. So if you can use a Chromebook and do everything on the cloud remotely, then it's fine. Then it just comes down to having a nice keyboard and a nice monitor, and the rest is all remote. And I think that's interesting because, you know, tools like Nuke are critical. I mean, the first time I learned to do compositing, I knew a little bit of After Effects before that. But the first time I really sat with a real compositor was at Digital Domain with Nuke before it was a product that came out. And I was sat there and it was just a blank gray screen and you had nothing. You had one node in the middle that said viewer. I'm like, how do I even start? And it was fascinating to me. It's like, it suddenly explained how you build and you build and it became so liberating to think about that tool as, because it really is so complicated, but it starts with nothing. And you just build this mesh of ideas as you go through. It's like a brain map. So when I saw like node-based compositing, that was my first experience in it in Nuke. And I was like, this is really amazing what it can do. But it can be some of the most simple thing possible to the most incredible comps I've ever seen. And learning from compositors and all of those things is such an important role to play. Do you see tools like that you guys are offering, obviously, as very big in the visual effects world, but do you see them have a bigger role in the overall computer graphic world that is going to affect more than visual effects and other things?
Yeah, it's a great question. And actually, you know, following a bit of the people and some of the products, we've actually spent a meaningful amount of time in design lately, particularly with the Modo team. You know, and that was always part of that business, going all the way back to Luxology. And, you know, not unlike Chaos Group, outside of visual effects and animation, you know, I'm sure there's some overlap in customers there. But particularly right now, this drive towards digital product creation and what that means in footwear, accessories, consumer packaged goods, now more than ever, there's an interest. You know, there already was, you know, and you'd see in our case studies looking on our website work that we'd done with New Balance and others in this space. But I think the demand for that, particularly given what we've experienced, is only going to continue to increase. You know, all of these big brands around the world have had, you know, innovation agendas for a number of years now, you know, working at different rates. You know, they're the same people that we would see attend SIGGRAPH because they will participate in the wider CG space, but, you know, not necessarily visual effects and animation per se. But many of those people in those organizations, this is their background. You know, they came from worlds where pipeline was important. The ability to translate data across applications was important. The ability to maintain quality of visualization throughout a process was important to them. And all of these things are equally applicable in enterprise design. So the design team with Modo and Colorway spend quite a lot of time there. And it's actually interesting to see the overlap both in people and product and process to some extent.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. I remember, you know, we obviously have a lot of similar customers in different areas. And I remember talking specifically to a customer. They were talking about using Katana in the automotive design world. And I'm like, why would you use Katana? And it just didn't make any sense because I always had this vision of what Katana is for, like, or what it was designed for. And then suddenly I was like, oh no, I need it because I need to create all these different configurations of a car of every single possibility. It's like, oh, yeah, Katana's perfect for that.
Exactly.
I just didn't even think about it. You know?
Yeah, when you distill it down to what could a rules-based workflow do that was non-destructive, rather than starting from a place of lighting and look dev. Yeah, the application certainly interesting there. And we do have customers in those adjacent spaces to us. Not a huge focus for us with Katana, but we definitely have interest and do have customers in that space.
Yeah, I think it's interesting just to think about like how that what that means and how that works. So let's, we kind of skipped a little bit forward, but I want to go back a little bit about Foundry and how Foundry, you know, started and I mean, obviously you've been the you're the new CEO now. You've been there, which is great, which is congratulations. I haven't said that
Thank you.
before, but very, very excited about that happening. But give us a little bit of a background about the Foundry and how that company started and you know what led it to be the company it is today.
Yes. Well, Foundry, founded in 1996 by Bruno Nicoletti and then Simon Robinson, our co-founder, who's actually still with us today, and started as a plugin company. I was actually a customer of Foundry buying plugins for the Sabre Group at ILM back in 2000. So when the big Inferno systems back in the day, so it really really focused on plugins for those early years, on into early 2000. I actually, when I moved to Digital Domain in 2007, my first office there was actually the D2 software office, which is really where Foundry, as part of DD and Nuke came together. And I guess it was 2008. Ownership had changed a few times, company had grown. Foundry was actually part of DD, and then there was a management buyout around that time. And at that point, Foundry separated Nuke and D2 Software out from Digital Domain, Foundry, and really then taken over. Of course, Jonathan Eggstadt, Bill Spitzcat was the original authors, working very closely with the team then in London. Foundry. So that's when the separation really started. So yeah, 2007, 2008, that same time period. And you know, Nuke, of course, flagship product. And then beyond that,
But that was a
it was
very
still early.
important product, a very important product, because that was the only real solution that was emerging at that time, right?
Exactly. It was the end of Shake. There wasn't another commercial solution out there. You know, various companies had their own internal compositors, but yes, this was the next big thing. And in many ways, I think everyone believed that by removing it from one house, it was going to give it new life with Foundry, you know, and then the opportunity to accelerate development, make it a commercial product with support with the commercial software company. That was the critical step in ensuring its ongoing growth and adoption across the industry.
And that's a big deal, a big deal. And then Foundry continued to get new software from that point, right? So like Katana, and then what was the other one I'm thinking of?
That's right, Katana and Flix from Sony, and then Mari texture painting
Mari,
from Weta.
from Weta, right? So basically, it seemed that there were some of these big studios were kind of eager to pass on some of their proprietary software to the Foundry. What was the, what do you think the motivation on was there? Is like, we don't want to develop this anymore because we might as well just give it back to the community. Was it that, or was it just too much work?
Probably a combination of all of the above. And you know, getting software through the transition of an internal product and what is used for all of the use cases, even in a studio that has film, commercial products, animation, and visual effects, to be a viable commercial product, it's a lot of work and a lot of support. And you know, and those were even before the days where we were trying to, you know, standardize on reference platform every year, every other year. And if that is not your core business, balancing the priorities of an internal studio and anyone else external, that's really hard to do. You know, in some ways, they're competition perhaps for the same type of work, depending on who you are in that ecosystem. So I think the opportunity to not only have someone else take on that IP, continuing developing it, even if they want to continue developing internally, it also helps seed the larger industry with talent that becomes trained on that product, which, as we all know, at the end of the day, if you don't have artists trained on your products, that's really going to limit how flexible you can be, both in the work you can take on, your ability to give artists the opportunity to move between projects and facilities. So that knowledge base in the industry is really important. And I think moving it outside, moving that IP out of house, the talent component is just as important as the long-term engineering and support.
Yes. But I got to say, the transition of Nuke from the in-house software that was Nuke, where all I had was a gray slate and a dot, and I had no idea where to go from there, to becoming the product that is today, where you, there's got to be a transition where, you know, I don't have an artist that wants to learn Nuke doesn't have the gift that I have where I can just go to Jonathan Eckstap and ask him, like, how do I make this work? Right. Cause that's what it was like at Didi. He invented Nuke and he told me how to make it work. Someone doesn't have that ability. So you have to create a whole new interface, a whole new way of thinking, a whole new way of adapting this specific in-house software to be more commonplace for people to learn and use. And that's gotta be a transition. That's gonna be tough, right?
Absolutely, because you're transitioning from, you know, even in the case of DD, the type of work we were known for, the type of work that was done in-house, that Nuke was fine-tuned for, once you move out of that and have different use cases, what you're trying to accommodate both in flexibility of workflow, user interface, as you already said, performance, support on all OSs, the wider that market is that you're trying to serve, it definitely introduces new challenges. Equally, I think the refinements that come with that kind of focus on UI, interop with other products, even now with standards, I think they benefit all users from that perspective. And I think, you know, our approach has always been and continues to be, we serve customers where the ability to pick and choose what products are you're going to be in your pipeline is extremely valuable. So that flexibility to work well with other products that are common in our industry and people that we all partner with, that's really important. And I think becomes of utmost importance once you take a product out of house as we did with Nuke.
Yeah, I think it was, it was definitely, you saw the transition, right? And you saw some of, I remember being a DD, people were like, oh, this doesn't look like Nuke. And it's like, well, it's not. you know, and it's like, well, you can't just give someone a blank slate and a gray dot and say good luck, you know. You have to give them something that works right. So it's a very different world. And it's funny because what I love is that I can actually, in Nuke, I should actually change it to be just exactly what I just said, but
exactly,
and so that's an interface that I can still appreciate. It is really, you know, powerful tool. Obviously, with things like Mari and things like Katana and Modo and all the products that you guys do, you're definitely the high end of visual effects in terms of that work, right? You guys have really focused on that. On those customers and those customers' needs. So it's pretty impressive what's been going on during that time. So you started off as part of operations at the Foundry, is that correct?
That's right. It wasn't intentional. It was supposed to be for a week-long stay.
Really?
Actually 2 days. When Bill Collis and Simon, our co-founder, Bill was our CEO at the time, called and said, we know we need some help. Why don't you just come over to London for a few days to help out and just meet the team? Because I had ever actually been over to London to visit, you know, in the time that Foundry separated from DD. And I was at DD for those next 5 years, a number of those with you. We kept in touch. They would come by the office. Of course, we were a customer at DD then, but we were a customer again.
Right.
So at any rate, I agreed to go over to London and visit for a few days and really, it was getting to spend time with the team that I realized how much, one, I missed the industry, but specifically missed test technology. In my roles at DD, they transitioned away from pure technology roles focused on software and hardware and systems to roles focused on artist management and studio management. And while I loved them and it was great to see the picture, I remembered everything I loved about technology in those few days in London. And so when they said, well, why don't you stay for a while? And I said, well, actually, I live in Austin now, not in London. They said, I'll just come back for a month. So I went back for a month, and a month led to 6 months, which led to a COO job again. And then that, few years passed, agreed to stay on, moved through various roles in product and customer. And frankly, similar to my roles at DD and even prior to that, ILM and Lucasfilm, largely jobs born out of business need for the work we were trying to do with the company at that time. And it actually wasn't until stepping into the CEO role this past summer that I realized I hadn't actually stepped into a job that existed before I had it since my first role. So a bit full circle 20 years later.
That's interesting. Okay, so you say you live in Austin, right? So
Mm-hmm.
now, so you still live in Austin, and that's great.
I
Love
still
Austin
live in
is,
Austin. Longest stretch I've been home in 7 years here.
right? That's great. What led you to Austin?
It was when I left DD, gosh, that was the end of 2012, post-bankruptcy, new team was set up. Knew I wanted a break. Wasn't sure what I was going to do next. And actually coming to Austin to visit friends, it had that creative talent and technology that I really liked about the Bay Area 20 years prior. But it was small, and it had a very small town feel, similar to where I grew up. But it still had all of that potential. And because I wasn't sure what was going to be next, it seemed like there's going to be something here. And that was it. So moved without a job, and was enjoying that break when Bill and Simon called from Foundry. And then 7 years passed, and here we are.
Well, I
Been
love
commuting ever
Austin.
since. It's
I
pretty
love
good.
Austin. Yeah, I used to live in Houston for a long time, so I used to go to Austin, and it's great. Obviously, there's a lot of creative stuff going on there. It's a pretty town. Weird things like the Bat Bridge, like all of that stuff. And I love that, which is, by the way, if people don't know, there's a bridge in Austin that houses, I think, about 5 million bats that live underneath the
Oh,
bridge.
yeah.
And then if when the sun sets, they all come out at once, and it's the most beautiful particle system you'll ever see. It's just
It
this
is
cloud of
gorgeous.
bats that comes out. It's really pretty to see that. But since you've stay, live in Austin, and you're working for a company in London, and you're the CEO, you seem to have figured out remote working pretty well, I'm sure, at this point, right?
I think I'd have given you a different answer depending on the week before all of this, but I do, because we have such a distributed team and a distributed customer base. There's almost 300 of us. We have There's the London office, Manchester. There's about 20 people in the Austin office here, in support and sales. Small team in Sydney, of course, the team in APAC, and then our customers are distributed. So between time in London, time on the road seeing customers, the home base, I think particularly over the last 3 years or so, has become less relevant, to be perfectly honest. I think it would have been more difficult had I still been on the West Coast. I mean, I think what you do covering 10 hours, I don't think
That's
I
10
could
hours
do
is a
that.
lot. No.
Not enough overlap where central time zone, 6 hours with London, great amount of time with the West Coast, overlap with Australia, APAC is needed in the evening. It's actually central time zone. I think it's no mistake a lot of companies have their America's operations here because it's pretty nice coverage.
It's true. My day starts you know, about 6 o'clock in the morning when my alarm goes off and I have 15 emails or 20 emails that I have to answer right away. So it's a little tough. And then you have to do it all by like 10 o'clock. Otherwise, you're not going to get an answer to the next day. That is a little tough, but it's still manageable. It's still manageable. You can work with it. That is the hardest part of remote working is time zones, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also very liberating, you know, and the same thing like this, you know, one of the things about this podcast, I always wanted to do them in person, as I've mentioned before, and that's why I was waiting for you to come to LA at some point. That's changed our situation. And then suddenly I said, well, we're going to have to find a solution. So I found these this remote podcast system, and suddenly so many more people are coming out saying, yeah, sure, I'll do that.
Yeah.
I just got an email from been communicating with Andy Lomas.
Great.
And because he's done some amazing research in deep learning and aesthetics, and I saw his paper about that. I was like,
yeah,
well, let's just
great
do a podcast.
Artwork too.
Yeah. So let's do a podcast with him. And he's like, great, I'm in London. It's like, so we'll work it out with the time zones and it's fine. If you're willing to become a little more flexible, you can actually reach out to a whole lot more people. But you're right though. Central time zone. That's pretty good.
No, it's a pretty good setup. I think, you know, the way the team has been flexible, not just this, but I think the interest across the team also in getting out into the market with our customers, and not just product people and sales, but developers, product designers, over the past few years. I think one of the learnings from being at DD and before that in the Bay Area, you know, when people weren't connecting or able to problem solve quickly, there was always something so powerful about having a developer go sit next to an artist that was using their product, you know. And I remember Craig or Doug would have someone do that at DD, and it was like, well, get out of your desk, walk over and find out what's going on. And what you can learn by sitting next to someone for even an hour without even talking or asking questions, just observing them use the product that you're working on and the challenges that they hit, it's so valuable. And I think, you know, when I think about how I would replace some of that engagement right now, those are some of the things I've been considering, because I do think for product designers, our engineering teams, the access to customers, it's so important. It's really important. And I think not having that opportunity is tough over long term. You know, I think while we can all be great on Zoom and on video, and we're better connected than ever, you know, how do we find ways to fill in the gaps that would have otherwise been filled by in-person interaction and communication?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. What do you think, you know, what are some of the things that you believe are going to be the future of what we're doing in terms of, you know, the technology and the stuff in you know, specifically in the visual effects world, because I think that's something that you guys play such an important part in. Do you think there's going to be some new ideas and new paradigm shifts that are happening in the next few years? Obviously, everything's changed now, so we don't really, there's a lot of questions we don't know the answer to, but do you think that there's going to be some ideas of what technology is going to become in the next, you know, 5 years or so?
I think the overall focus of the industry on both efficiency at scale, because the demand for content, even through this, continues to be high and will continue to be, and what that means for people in visual effects and animation, as it relates to performance, as it relates to freeing up artists' time more and more through more innovative workflows, not necessarily full automation, but everything that machine learning can bring us in tools to make artists more efficient. Mm. I think all of those things continue to become more important. You know, when I think about the longer term horizon and enabling technologies like machine learning, where our research team's been spending some time and is doing more work, you know, beyond the open source server they released, but getting that actually into nodes and products so that it's useful for artists. Real time is part of workflows, not just as a technology in and of itself, but from a standpoint of accelerating decision making, and where does that live in traditional workflows and change it, and how does that change pipelines long term? And then, of course, back to this remote working and focus on how to accelerate for our customers greater flexibility in hybrid environments. You know, what does that mean for data? What does that mean for having a distributed pipeline and teams of people? And how do we ensure our existing products now and next generation products are prepared to not just survive in that environment, but actually make artists even more able to spend time doing what they want to do, you know, and that's on creative process, not on repetitive work. So I think those three themes overarching, you know, our own strategic plan and where our initiatives were for 2020 and continue to be, I don't see those changing. And in fact, you know, as I reflect on the things that, you know, when I kicked off the planning process with the team last September after stepping into this role, you know, everything that we talked about that was important in 3, 5 years and beyond, if anything, what has happened over the last 3 or 4 months has only solidified the importance of all of those things and that longer term investment, you know, beyond what's on the roadmap for this year. But how do we ensure that we're well placed to support our customer base long term in that way? So definitely more on that soon.
I'm finding it a little bit ironic that obviously, you know, and sad that, you know, a lot of productions, a lot of work has stopped and people have had a hard time dealing with that. But at the same time, the demand for content has skyrocketed because people are stuck at home, you know? And so suddenly there is this huge demand for content and the world has to adapt to what kind of content they're consuming or what that world is like. I've been sitting here thinking, it's like, you know, this could very well be a very disruptive, something that was, I believe, was inevitable in terms of the film industry, right? And the inevitability that traditional filmmaking, movie theater experiences are going to be disrupted heavily by this. But at the same time, the demand for people to see high quality content is still very, very high. And the world of streaming is obviously going to change a lot. What that new landscape is going to look like and the kinds of content that people expect. Do you think that, you know, what the world of streaming is, does that change how you view the technology you're working on, you know, going from traditional film stuff to like more of a streaming and online world? Do you think that changes the way technology adapts itself?
Perhaps for us, less so, because we're a bit one step removed. I think it's the overall demand and increase for content that's driving this need for efficiency, the ability to move data, not just within, you know, single studios, but multiple studios, the ability to do that efficiently at scale, the need for consistency of visualization from start to finish at the earliest stages of pre-vis through virtual production, if you will, through delivery, the challenges of data and carrying data through pipelines end to end. Those things, whether the content is viewed in your living room or in a car on an iPad or in the movie theater, less important, I think, for us in that way. I think, of course, you know, in the near term, you know, as we talk to so many of our customers, you know, it's a bit of a mix of impact with, you know, of course, many in animation still busy and working, albeit remotely. Others, of course, doing post work have enough to keep them going for a period of time, some a
until
few months,
the next
some
batch
longer,
had, right.
some shorter. Exactly. Yeah. So I think what happens in, you know, this quarter and into Q3, probably greater unknown, you know, as we start to see things perhaps recover more in Q4. But I think that big question about live action production, you know, and I think we've all been hearing about some of the projects moving entirely to animation while they figure out what that looks like in the future. That's a big question mark for me. You know, what does live action look like?
Yeah. I mean, I remember the time when the writer's strike happened, right? And all of a sudden they came up with this new idea called a reality show to try, right? And all of a sudden, the reality show, we thought it was just going to be there to, you know, to stave off the entertainment industry while they did, but it stuck around. And so I have this feeling that animation is going to be a new medium that's going to emerge. Not new, it's not a new medium, obviously, but it's going to become more important as people decide, well, we're just going to continue work with animation in some case. I don't think live action is going away or will go away, but I think animation is going to have an important role in our future.
Mm-hmm. No, I completely agree. So it's certainly what comes out of this and the inventiveness that I think we're already seeing from a number of our customers. Really, really impressive. I think even just from a creative standpoint and rethinking what their approaches were to some of these projects. So lots of learning to be done.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I think I think it's amazing. I think it's really cool that, you know, that while we're struggling to figure out how to deal with the situation, but I think that we're going to come up with some very interesting ideas. And I really, and I'm glad to have, you know, companies like your company and my company. It's like, well, let's figure out what we can do to make these customers happy and be able to continue to make great content, because there is a demand for this stuff. And there's a demand for high quality work. And the fact that we can enable our both our customers to work from home is also a big deal for us. So
really,
thank you for doing that.
When I saw your response, and I also of course love the picture of Flato's dog on the website. The way the industry has come together, I think, number one, the resilience, and two, just the willingness to try to work together to make this all work for however long it lasts, and to be flexible with each other. And whether that's supporting students at home right now that are outside of school and want to learn and work on our products, and the skill up events that, you know, a number of us I know are holding, to supporting the commercial work that continues on with everyone remote. It's so important, because it does take everyone working together to get to the other side of this. And that, you know, in the Silver Linings group, I think that to me, day to day, through all of the challenges that we're facing, is the best part.
Absolutely. I know my wife's a flame artist, and so she's home right now. Unfortunately, her flame is locked up in the building. And she says, well, I think it's a good time for me to brush up on my nuke skills. So she's
love that.
So she's like, let's learn some nuke while I'm here. So I was like, great, we'll set you up with that. So
exactly.
you guys offer that ability. So, like, you know, extend that time that you can try it. You can try
absolutely.
It
absolutely.
So that really helpful.
No, it's good. It's really good. No, I think the amount of learning actually that's been happening while people are remote has been so impressive to me, not just our products, but just in general, people, the interest in picking up new skills and skills development during this time, mm-hmm. I think to mix up the time at home, it's just been really impressive to see. I love that.
Yep. Yep. I'm picking up tying flies. That's another thing I'm picking up on my free time.
To go fly fishing?
Yeah. Yes.
I like that.
Yeah. Just something.
In LA? Really?
Yes, actually, you can, well, if you're from the Central Coast, actually, you can actually fly fish on the in the surf. It's actually one of the most challenging fly fishing I've ever done. But
really, it's cold out there. Yes,
yeah,
I was born in Lompoc. I know that neighborhood, and surf is cold. That is not a beach.
Yeah, no, it's tough, but there's some very interesting things down there, and there's a great community that I found online that helps you figure out what kind of materials to, and it's like, all of a sudden, this whole other world has appeared that would never have happened if I hadn't just like, I'm just going to pick that up.
That's impressive. That's really impressive. That's good learnings right now. I think, the work that people have been doing, you know, besides the crafting of models at home and the enormous amount of cooking that's been happening. Yeah, all the projects coming out of people's homes right now. It's pretty impressive to see. But that's the first time I've heard creating flies for fly fishing.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. Well, thank you so much for doing this. This has been an amazing talk, and you're always great to hear from you. But, you know, at some point when things do settle in and you're able to make it out to LA or I come to Austin, I'll definitely want to stop by and see each other in person. That would be great.
I would like that. No, I'm, well, I expected us to be doing this in LA around an NAB trip. I'm glad this worked out. It was really good to see you.
Perfect.
All right. I can't believe you're almost at 300 podcasts. It's impressive. I look forward to the 300th.
Well, thank you. Me too. I can't believe it either. Every time I see the number of the episode, I was like, what? So, yeah.
You're going to get there faster than you think now that you're going to have people signed up from all over the world.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's true. Well, thank you, Jody.